In his latest book, historian and NPR commentator Mitch Myers demonstrates his love for most any kind of popular music. The Boy Who Cried Freebird combines fact, fiction, and combinations of both into a series of essays. Part of its name comes from a Lynyrd Skynyrd song, one known to be requested by many concertgoers, regardless of who's on stage. AMBD's Jeff Bossert spoke with Myers.
It is something of a hackneyed tradition in rock and roll now to go to a concert and yell Freebird, whether it's a jazz show or a soft rock or anything you're apt to name. It's done in an ironic way, and usually a desperate attempt for a laugh by a member of an audience. And what I have found, before I talk about the book, is that when I do talk to musicians about it who have read the book or know the story, which I have told on All Things Considered, is that they've encountered it a great deal, and most musicians already in their mind know how they're going to deal with this when it does come up.
Early on, we're exposed to Adam Coyle. Talk about your literary alter ego, if that's the best way of explaining him. Talk about him and how he kind of emulates you, maybe at a younger age.
As far as him being my alter ego, I think that when an author, you know, inhabits a character or tries to make him come alive in a book and draws from some experiences, certainly you could say he might have some similarities with anyone that grew up in the 70s and went to rock shows. He is and he isn't. I haven't done it, but I know people that have. It could have been me just as easily as not. And as the book goes on, and there's about 43 different chapters in the book, there's about a good 7 or 10 where Adam does make an appearance, and he's thrown into a variety of situations, most of which have to do with music in some way, whether it be concert going or listening to records or just being one of those kind of people. And I think the book is really geared towards people who have a little fanaticism towards music. And if there's anything that, you know, he would share with myself, that's what it would be.
Talk about the order in which these essays and stories kind of line up, because you start out with some shorter write-ups and things that we might be hearing on All Things Considered, and then slowly you bring in write-ups that we might just see in a magazine, something about Doug Somm or Terry Riley, little-known artists, or maybe underappreciated ones like Frank Zappa. Was there a rhyme and reason as the way the articles appeared and you started seeing more rock journalist type stuff later on?
Well, I think the book was most definitely sequenced in a very, very specific way, and that was intentional. In lieu of the title, The Boy Who Cried Freebird, Rock and Roll Fables and Sonic Storytelling, I wanted to initially establish that there's a fabulous element, a fictional kind of tweak to the stories that we're telling, even if they're based on factual events of some sort, and that we take the recording session between Phil Spector and Tina Turner when they recorded River Deep and Mountain High, and the story is told more or less in a straightforward fashion, except for the fact that it's told from the perspective of a fictitious musician who was at the session and played glockenspiel. And as we go forward, there's a Robert Johnson ghost story, one of which I told on NPR on Halloween one day. But then I anchored the book and peppered the book throughout with larger and more serious pieces of music journalism in hopes to anchor it for the serious music fan that would pick this book up and really want to know about these artists and their histories. And I am a historian, and I am a serious musicologist, and if I'm talking about Art Blakey and Thelonious Monk and their relationship and the recordings that they collaborated on together, you can bet that pretty much every date in that book has been checked, and the titles of the albums have been checked, and everything is, you can take it to the bank, you can look it up, and it'll be there.
Baby, don't you want to go?
Well, let's talk about the Robert Johnson ghost story. Is there something to do, perhaps, with the allure of Robert Johnson's death? He was supposedly poisoned, and there's all this controversy as to where he's buried. Did that have maybe some influence as to why you wrote an essay about a hidden track on a CD that couldn't be recorded on tape?
Right, a kind of ghostly track that appears at the end of a CD. I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you listen to a disc and you think it's over and there's about 10 15 minutes of silence and all of a sudden something will pop back up. Well, that's kind of, it took that little premise and applied it to the myth and legends about Robert Johnson. I mean, whether or not he sold his soul to the devil on the crossroads for the sake of becoming an immensely talented individual for the short time he'd be on Earth, And so it really, in a way, it's basically just an update of an old American folktale, just like the movie Crossroads was before this. And if you look at that and you look at this, you start to see the parallels and the kind of complementary nature of all these things. It's not that different. It just might have a little bit more technology, i.e., it's more of a 21st century or a late 20th century type of experience. We see this in literature all the time, where you might take a classic folktale and kind of just modernize it. And that's what I do, not just in the Robert Johnson story to a small extent, but also in John Henry and the Wheels of Steel. I don't know if you're familiar with the legend of John Henry back in the 1800s, but when they were laying train tracks across the country, they needed people to actually take hammers and break through the rock of the mountains in order to lay these tracks down. And there were songs and legends written about John Henry, and they were sung by everybody from Josh White to, any folk singer that you're apt to name from the 1950s and 60s, the legend of John Henry would pop up. Well, the original story, he challenges a rock-crushing machine and wants to prove that he, a man, is better than the machine and can do his job better than being replaced by a machine. And they have a contest a certain amount of time, and they both have to see who's going to break more rock, John Henry, the mountain of a man, or this rock-busting machine that they had brought in. And John Henry challenges and defeats the machine, but then he lays down and dies because he had to exert himself. In my story, John Henry is a jazz drummer. It's set in modern times, and he's being replaced by a DJ at the nightclub where he plays. And he, in order to try and salvage his job and his self-respect, challenges the DJ to a one-on-one drummer versus DJ, and we replicate that man versus machine story, which has been around for a couple hundred years now.
A lot of these stories seem like dreams, like it would be real easy to picture you traveling back in time and seeing the dead perform, and you put Adam Coyle the Fifth into a story like that.
Right. There's a dreamlike quality to some of them, and I hope that kind of helps people get into an attitude where they're reading these and that they don't work too hard or take it too seriously and kind of let it kind of take over. When we go to the films and the auteurs really ask us to suspend our disbelief. And if we're not so concerned for the first part of the show, whether or not this is fact or fiction, because pretty much you can figure it out as the things do unfold, we start to get a handle on things, and the dreamlike quality, I hope, is a credit to the writing in terms of the atmosphere and the kind of ambiance that I hoped to create in some of these pieces. And that's, again, why we kind of offset those pieces with some hard journalism, because I think a single book of all straight rock stories, you know, journalistically speaking, or a book of all fiction might have been a little bit too much for any one person to handle.
A lot of the stories that really stay with me are one or two pages. And one that stood out with me is I'm a really big fan of the movie Almost Famous.
Oh, sure.
And you talked about how a friend of yours was looking for, is this an actual person?
So you want to know whether the story revolving around Almost Famous
yes.
is true or not true? No, it is not
okay.
true. But I have had many people come up to me and tell me that they knew somebody that had an experience very similar to that.
Well, I think it's the best case in the history of TV and movies creating fictional bands in my life of wanting a band to be real, even though we knew it wasn't.
So you were a Sweetwater fan is what you're telling me.
Stillwater, correct?
Stillwater,
yes. Yes, I even brought the CD up with me to include some music in the show.
Well, play Fever Dog, that's my request.
Okay.
Well, Almost Famous, we know the film was created by Cameron Crowe, and it is based loosely on his own life story. As a very young person, becoming a journalist and writing for Rolling Stone magazine and having the opportunity to interview some pretty popular rock musicians of his time. And he was interviewing these people in a very serious way when he was under 20 years old. And he created this movie kind of in tribute to his own experience and the people that he looked up to, like Lester Bangs, who he kind of makes into a patron saint in that movie. And again, I think that he and I must be pretty much of the same generation. I just turned 50 this past year. He can't be much more than that. And certainly his experience as a journalist, which went back all the way to the early 70s, was far more extensive and serious than mine. But he was he started to turn into a more of a fabulist and creating scenarios around these experiences, much akin to my own. So I identified very strongly. I tried to create a situation where, again, it was quite believable. Somebody fell in love with the movie Almost Famous and wanted to buy all the records by all the bands that were in the movie. And when he came to the group Stillwater, he found out to his disappointment that they don't really exist. And then what ensues, and the punchline I'll hopefully save for somebody to read and decide if it's funny on their own.
Have you had a chance to talk to Cameron Crowe?
I didn't talk to him, but he sent me a very complimentary note, and we're using it for a blurb on the book. It's going to say, Mitch, loved your book, rich with truth, soul, and music. So I think that I got the nod from the Godfather, and I'm very happy and excited enough to repeat that on the radio.
Your uncle was Shel Silverstein, and you still run his archive in Chicago.
That's correct.
What you credit or what did you inherit from him in finding a voice for some of these stories?
Well, I think that being around somebody that was as intensely creative and brilliant as Shel was as a young person, as a boy growing into a man, I would claim to be inspired just by his work ethic and attitude towards being creative, which he put up pretty much above all else. He was a very kind man and a very sweet person to the people that he knew and loved, and there were many. But he also was an artist first and foremost. And when he did write or try to create something, he was not just an author of children's books, but he was also a cartoonist and a songwriter. And he wrote many hit songs in the 70s, like Cover the Rolling Stone and Sylvia's Mother for Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show, or Boy Named Sue for Johnny Cash. But he would never let go of something before it was done, as in he would work on something until the law of diminishing returns would kick in, as in if you touch it anymore, you're just going to make it worse. But most people are not in the position nor have the attitude to work that hard, and I think I did get that attitude from Shel and approaching my work is to really throw myself into it completely until I was satisfied with every comma and every period and the pacing and the timing and the language and the form that I was really trying to address. So I got that. I mean, if my sense of humor is at all akin to him, I can't really say. I would never compare myself to Shel. I mean, he was a giant and a Renaissance man that was beyond words in my estimation. And here I am, a humble author, hustling a book of music stories. But I think there is a timeless nature to a lot of the pieces in my book. And that means that it transcends. I think some of these stories can be read by very young people or people that are far, far more mature in age and wisdom as well. And timeless writing is something that you can't put a price on. And if I attain that at all, I'll be thrilled.
AM 580's Jeff Bossert spoke with NPR commentator Mitch Myers about his latest book, The Boy Who Cried Freebird, Rock and Roll Fables and Sonic Storytelling. It's published by HarperCollins.